You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite the predictions of many pundits, the events following the Iranian elections in July 2009 did not signify the beginning of the end of the Islamic Republic. However, at the time, it was hard to find anyone who could provide an explanation for the situation or who could forecast the ultimate outcome of what appeared to be mass civil discontent among Iranians. In his latest book, The Ayatollah's Democracy and an Iranian Challenge, Humam Majd places the election and subsequent Green Movement in the context of Iranian history. It is published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased to welcome Humam Majd back to our show. Hello.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Hindsight is 2020, but you say that even at the time, it was wrong to see the events of the summer of 2009 as the beginning of the end of the Islamic Republic. What led you to feel that regime change wasn't in the offing when so many people felt it might be?
Well, so many people abroad felt it might be.
Was that just wishful thinking?
I think it was certainly wishful thinking on the part of the media and even on the part of certain governments and a lot of people who dislike the Islamic Republic and, of course, the Iranian diaspora, which can be very influential in the media. It wasn't because the leaders never intended it to be a revolution. Its potential was that it could lead to a revolution, but because it didn't have a leadership that was calling for a revolution, it was very unlikely for it to be a revolution.
Well, would a majority of the protesters have welcomed a revolution?
That's difficult to say whether a majority. I think, first of all, we had 3 million people, 3 to 4 million people come out on the streets. The biggest demonstration was 3 to 4 million people in Tehran. Would they have wanted a revolution? Their call at the day they came out was for a recount of the vote or a new vote. That was their main demand. I think a smaller proportion would have welcomed a revolution. Yes, absolutely.
Well, at the time, what did you predict would happen when the protests subsided, that things would just eventually return to the way they were before?
I tried not to make any predictions because I felt it was a dangerous game to play. And Iran is very unpredictable and always has been the political situation in Iran. At the time, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if Khamenei, who was the supreme leader, was going to give in to the demands or he saw something that he didn't expect, for example. It was very difficult to tell what was going to happen.
Well, he was receiving pressure from other members of the clergy, which was interesting.
Yes, he was.
And
absolutely.
That remains part of the complicated situation in Iran. Not everybody is unified. There was a time when there was a feeling that almost everybody in leadership was unified.
Yes, and they certainly were unified during the 80s when there was the Iran-Iraq War. Again, a threat, an outside threat, unified them, even though internally there were still disagreements among the Ayatollahs back even in the 80s. And the 90s, as Iran opened up a little bit more, there was more disagreement. You saw that with Khatami's presidency and the challenges to him. And then, of course, with Ahmadinejad, even in the first term of Ahmadinejad, you saw a lot of challenges to him by the clergy and by other politicians.
Lots of books have been written about Iran by people like you who wear both Iranian and American hats. What misconceptions about Iran persist that you were hoping to explain with this book?
Well, I think with this particular book, I talk very much about the political culture. And the misconceptions that we have in America are, one is that there was going to be a revolution, for example, with this Green Movement, or that the Green Movement can lead to a revolution. Even just a couple of days ago, there was an article in an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that, America should actually be supporting the Green Movement because if this opposition comes to power, there will be a complete change, which is actually a misconception because nobody in Iran, there are no political leaders in Iran who would really change the foreign policy of Iran at this point.
Well, what about the significance of the color green?
Well, the significance of the color green, because it's the color of Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, the color
so
of Islam.
So that would suggest that it was a religious movement to some degree.
It certainly was. Mir Hossein Mousavi, who was the leader of the Green Movement, of the Green Wave, when he was a candidate for the presidency, chose that color specifically to represent Islam and his movement. So it was always tied to Islam, and the political culture in Iran is going to be Islamic for the foreseeable future, even though there are people in Iran, obviously, who would prefer a secular system.
So it wasn't inspired at all by Ukraine's Orange Movement?
No, it wasn't. It's hard to say. I don't believe I was in Iran during the election and campaign. I never heard that from any but the leaders of the Green Movement, that they were inspired by the Orange Revolution. No.
Well, you said that there's a large, sizable secular segment in the society. And didn't those people join the GREB movement, the artists and the university students and people who are just not religious?
Yes,
would
absolutely.
Like to see an easing of all of the religious restrictions?
Absolutely, absolutely. But you have to look at the country as a whole and not just the intelligentsia or just Tehran or just northern Tehran in some cases. I mean, Ahmadinejad, for example, still does represent a certain part of Iran as much as Mousavi does, in the same way that George Bush represented America, even if we didn't like the idea that he represented America, even at the depths of his presidency when he had an approval rating of 22 or 23%, that's still an awful lot of people. And I think Ahmadinejad represents some part of Iran and still has some popular support. I don't know what that support is today, whether it's 25, 35, or 45%, but it is significant in numbers.
They did use religion rather pragmatically, arranging protests on days that coincided with religiously significant days. But some people saw simply as a way to make a crackdown a little more difficult.
Well, it's two things. One, it did make a crackdown a little bit more difficult. But secondly, and also the cries of Allahu Akbar made, how do you start beating somebody up who's saying God is great? That was also intentional on the Green Movement's part. But the other thing is about the picking the religious holidays. Those are the days that people can go out on the streets and either protest or cheer or participate in festivities for the religious occasion. So it was a convenient way to get on the streets.
You say that too many people claimed that they were green, such as the son of the former Shah. Mm-hmm. Isn't it up to the individual, even if he is the Shah's son, to decide whether or not to be part of something like a green movement?
Sure, absolutely. It's everybody's right to decide if they want to be part of a green movement. But his goals, in the case of the Shah's son or in the case of the Mujahideen, the MEK, their goals are very different from the green leaders. So the green leaders themselves have used the word hijacked, that their movement was hijacked by outsiders.
Were they uncomfortable when U2 flashed pictures of Iranian protests against a green backdrop at their concerts?
Not at all. Not at all. That kind of display of support for the Iranian people, no, is actually something that even Karoubi, for example, one of the candidates in the election.
The more conservative Islamic candidate.
Well, he's a candidate, but he's actually now become more liberal than any of them.
Turned around because of this experience?
Yes, because he's the one who called out the government on rapes in prison, and rape in prison and torture and so on and so forth. But he's actually said in interviews that they welcome moral support. Certainly by non-governmental organizations or non-governmental people like Bono and U2, but they certainly don't want any help by foreign governments.
My guest is Humam Majd, whose latest book is The Ayatollah's Democracy, an Iranian Challenge. It is published by Norton. Are minority rights for Kurds and Jews and Armenians, Zoroastrians and Baha'is part of the demands of the Green Movement?
They haven't been up till now. Or they haven't been the most important demands by the Green Movement, although they certainly fall into the Green Movement's manifesto that there should be rights for everybody and the rights of everybody should be respected in Iran. Every Iranian should be respected. Baha'i is an interesting thing. I do talk about this in the book. The Baha'is are different from other minorities in that there's very little support among the leadership to give them the rights, unfortunately, that they deserve, the same rights as all other citizens.
Baha'i started in Iran.
It started in Iran, but it's
viewed—
They
would be a little proud.
Unfortunately, because the founder of the faith, Baha'u'llah, was actually a cleric, an ayatollah or a mullah, who basically his followers proclaimed him to be the Mahdi, the missing imam, the messiah. So that's heresy in Islam, and certainly in Shia Islam it's heresy. And so viewing them as a heretical sect makes it easy for the government to suppress their religion.
Well, I would think there'd be a bit more tolerance because Shia is seen as a heresy by Sunni.
Sunnis, yes.
So, everybody's heretic is the next person's saint.
Yes, the oppressed tend to oppress.
What role did women play in the Green Movement? They seem to be a large force in it and even produce the movement's most famous martyr.
Absolutely. And I think women were a large force in the movement. And I think part of that came initially because of the wife of one of the candidates, Mir Hossein Mousavi, was very visible for the first time ever on an Iranian presidential campaign. You had the wife of one of the candidates campaigning openly and talking about women's rights and talking about issues that affect women in Iran. And so I think that led to a surge in interest among women in Iran to see that their vote might make a difference in their lives. And of course, subsequent to losing or the fraudulent election, women became much a real force for the Green Movement.
Were any of the prominent clergy who have expressed dissatisfaction with the Ahmadinejad regime participants in the movement?
Indirectly. I mean, certainly, for example, Khatami, a former president, was very active in the movement early on, but he's backed off a lot.
Well, he withdrew from the race so that he could help Mousavi.
Exactly.
Because he wanted to draw votes away from him. Were they in general agreement?
Khatami had said before he ran for the presidency for the third time, he said that he would not run if Mousavi would run. And Mousavi decided at the last minute in March of 2009 to run, and Khatami threw his support to him, yes.
Well, how different was Mir Hossein Mousavi's reform platform from the former president Khatami?
Not very different at all.
Well, didn't he learn something from the fact that Khatami couldn't get any of his reforms through?
Well, Khatami got some of his reforms through and got some things done. He did learn, and that was the whole idea, and I think that's what threatened the conservatives or the arch conservatives in Iran this time round, was that basically the reform movement was saying it's going to be different this time. Oddly enough, President Ahmadinejad has set a precedent for future presidents in Iran. He's taken much, much more power into the presidency, and this precedent is something that the Green Movement and the reformists are well aware of, and they intended to use the same kind of power.
Didn't Ahmadinejad present himself as a reform candidate?
Well, he presented himself as a different candidate. He wouldn't use the word reform.
Well, he's something of an outsider because he's not from the clerical elite.
He's not from the clerical elite. He's not from the revolutionary elite at the time of the revolution.
And he seems to want to ease certain restrictions on male-female relations.
Yes, this is the contradiction. And I think that a lot of people believe that's because he wants to appeal to some of the people in the Green Movement to bring them into the fold, into his fold. And that may be a cynical move. But I actually think that Ahmadinejad would like to be a much more secular leader as long as he has the power.
You say that Mousavi is not a particularly charismatic person. Do Iranians find Ahmadinejad more charismatic and more charming?
Well, the Iranians who don't like him don't, no. But obviously his
outsiders
supporters
find him kind of crude and boorish.
Yes, crude and boorish, absolutely. And most Iranians, certainly the people who supported Mousavi or supported any of the other candidates, find him exactly the same. But he does have supporters who do find him, yes, charming and you know, a consummate politician.
Now, President Obama said that he didn't see much difference ultimately in dealing with Ahmadinejad or Mousavi. Do they differ in terms of their policy toward nuclear weapons?
They don't. They don't differ. I mean, they both would say, in fact, any of the Iranian leadership, anybody in the Iranian leadership would say basically the same thing, that Iran is not looking to build a nuclear weapon. Iran is going to continue exercising its right to enrich uranium. Mousavi said this, and President Obama was absolutely right. And in fact, I would venture to say that if there were change in Iran, if the Supreme Leader would allow there to be a change in Iran, if Mousavi were president tomorrow, after all of his experiences in the last year and a half, he would still maintain that same policy, and he would also still maintain a general foreign policy that would be similar to what we see now.
Now, you said that Khatami got some of his reforms through, but basically he faced a lot of resistance. And I was reading about cynicism, a growing cynicism among the people who most wanted reform. Did they drop that cynicism during the election?
They did during the election.
That maybe things would change? Didn't the fact that so many candidates were disqualified before the election suggest that perhaps things would not improve?
No, I think Iranians are used to the fact that many candidates get disqualified, and there were four candidates running, obviously the president and three others who were staunchly opposed to him. But there was an incredible energy in Iran and an incredible sense of freedom in Iran actually during the campaign, whether the government did that intentionally for people to let off steam. I mean, it was a really, you know, exuberant kind of atmosphere in Tehran, and a feeling that there was this possibility of real change because nobody was stopping them from dancing on the streets and celebrating Green and celebrating Mousavi's campaign at the time. And I think the cynicism returned after a few weeks after they saw the brutal repression.
Mousavi also had the endorsement of Ayatollah Rafsanjani, who many call the second most powerful man in Iran. What makes him so powerful?
Well, he has, first of all, he's the chairman of the Assembly of Experts, which is a body that elects and supervises the performance of the supreme leader, and that's a very important position. He's also chairman of the Expediency Council, so he's also that's another body that arbitrates between the Guardian Council and the Parliament, so that's another very important position that he holds.
Well, has all of that been undermined by his support of Mousavi and what's happened since?
It was initially, although
he in China, he would have probably have been put under house arrest.
In China or in the old Soviet Union, he may have been killed, yes. But no, in Iran, it was undermined to some degree. A good example is that Kayhan, which is a newspaper which is very close to the supreme leader, the editor is picked by the editor-in-chief is picked by the supreme leader, stopped calling him Ayatollah after the elections of 2009. But interestingly enough, 2 or 3 weeks ago, they started calling him Ayatollah again. Clearly, you know, the supreme leader has approved his reinstatement as an Ayatollah, which is very important in Iran. But he's one of the early revolutionaries. He was very close to Khomeini. He has vast holdings in Iran. Apart from his wealth, he also has a lot of support among Revolutionary Guards, for example, and people like that.
Well, during the Soviet Union, though, these Kremlinologists who would note where somebody stood during a parade, I suspect we have something similar to Tehranologists now.
We do, yes.
We have to notice whether somebody's being called an Ayatollah or not.
Yeah.
My guest is Homan Majd, Homan Majd. His latest book, The Ayatollah's Democracy, An Iranian Challenge, it's published by Norton, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Homan Majd, who was born in Tehran but educated in England and America, the author of a number of books, the most recent, The Ayatollah's Democracy, An Iranian Challenge, published by Norton. Were there any new faces in the election? Everyone seems like they were the children of the 1979 revolution.
They were, yes. I mean, of the youngest candidate in the elections of 2009 was Ahmadinejad, actually. He was probably 20 years old at the time of the revolution. So he wasn't as active a participant in the revolution. He was a student then, as the others were. The other people who were in the race for the presidency.
Well, when did all these players who were once part of a unified movement, as we mentioned earlier, divide into conservatives and reform factions? Was there a particular event, or was it just dissatisfaction with the way things were going?
I think the maturation of the revolution. I mean, Rafsanjani was the first when he was president in the early 90s and into the late 90s before Khatami. He was the first to recognize that the revolution had matured and needed to move to the next phase. And as such, it needed to reform. The country needed to reform. He instituted some reforms. And then, of course, President Khatami came in 1997 as the real reform. That was really the first time Iranians understood that there could be reform and there could be an Islamic democracy.
Well, I don't think anyone imagined that the Shah could be overthrown in 1979, but he was. Were people imagining the same sort of thing here?
Well, I think a lot of people in the West were imagining that. But, you know, the thing about the Shah—
And they weren't imagining the overthrow of the Shah.
No, they weren't in the imagining. That it was quite the opposite, I guess. But I think during the Shah's time, what people in the West didn't really understand, and they only came to understand very close to the revolution, was that there was an incredible dissatisfaction with the Shah on a level that included virtually the entire country. I mean, toward the end of the Shah's reign, it was hard to find anybody who would support him or support the monarchy. And, you know, Iran really was a very popular revolution. Over 90% of the people wanted a change, a dramatic change from the Shah. And in the case of 2009, that just simply wasn't the case. The majority did not want a revolution. Certainly there were people who do and still do want a revolution. And the people who supported Ahmadinejad, moment, just assume that the results of the election were reversed, that in fact Ahmadinejad only got 35% or 32%.
Well, that may have been the case.
That may have been the case. And Mousavi got the 60% or 61%. That still would mean 30% to 50 million votes. That's a significant number of people who voted for Ahmadinejad despite all the things we know about him.
You were in Iran until just 10 days before the election.
Yes.
Didn't you want to stay?
I did, but this is where, you know, we get things wrong. Despite what the Green Movement was saying to me and the leaders of the Green Movement were saying to me, because at that point, a week before the election, they were saying, we're going to win now outright. And I had said I thought it was going to go to a second round. I didn't think that Mousavi, I thought Mousavi would get more votes than Ahmadinejad, but I didn't know that he would have more than 50%, which would then lead to a runoff. So I needed, I had been in Iran for a month at that point. I needed to come back. I had some things to do here. I was going to go back for the second round of the elections.
Can you vote?
I did. I did vote. Yes.
Have you voted in previous elections?
I voted in the previous one too. Yes.
So how soon after the elections did you return to Iran?
It was impossible to go back right away. I just went back this year in April, May.
Did you have any suspicions before the election that they might be fraudulent? Because there were warnings about vote tampering before the election. And there was an article in Time magazine on the day of the election reporting that a mass mobile text message circulated in the run-up telling voters to bring their own pens because rumors had it that in pro-Mousavi districts, they might hand out pens with invisible ink.
Yeah, I know. A lot of those we took as rumors and conspiracy theories, which are abundant in Iran and in a culture like Iran. But no, I think vote tampering was a concern to the extent that if it was going to be a very close vote. I mean, former President Khatami had told me on one occasion a couple of years ago that, you know, you really can't steal an election in Iran by more than 300,000 votes. That's the maximum they could swing it by. Most people felt that the election was going to be reasonably fair. There might be an attempt to throw 300,000 or 400,000 votes to Ahmadinejad. But at that point, people felt that Mousavi had pulled ahead by enough significantly. What's interesting is the Supreme Leader, a couple of weeks later, upped that number of 300,000 that Khatami had said to 1,000,000. He said, well, maybe you can, you know, there could be fraudulent votes by as many as 1,000,000, but you're talking about 10 million here, so it's not possible.
Well, when you say they can swing the vote, who are we talking about? Are we talking about Ahmadinejad and his government? Are we talking about the Supreme Leader and the people who work with him?
It's hard to say because the government is in control of the elections. So the government of President Ahmadinejad was controlling the elections. So
Khamenei fell in right behind him.
He certainly did.
And even
yes.
though they don't love Ahmadinejad, is that because they just saw him as the lesser of the two evils?
I think there was a real concern, and this is, again, speculation because the Supreme Leader won't discuss this or won't give interviews and really doesn't talk about these things. He doesn't even do press conferences. It's speculation, but I imagine that there was a sense among the hardliners and particularly, obviously, the Supreme Leader that the reformists, if they were to win this election, could potentially, at a time when their relations with the West and particularly the United States are very fragile, could end up negotiating away too much. And I think there was a preference among the hardliners from the clerics on down on the hardline side to have someone like Ahmadinejad who they knew would not give up Iran's rights. And, you know, the experience of the Khatami years where there was a sense that he gave a lot to the United States, helping the United States with Afghanistan with the approval of the Supreme Leader. He was rewarded with that by he was rewarded for that by the Axis of Evil speech of George Bush, and then worse relations. He suspended uranium enrichment, for example, with obviously the approval of the Supreme Leader. What did Iran get in return? Some empty promises, as far as the Iranians are concerned. So I think they were more comfortable with Ahmadinejad's much more belligerent foreign policy.
So the Bush administration totally was misreading what was going on in Tehran?
I believe so. Yes. Yes.
My guest is Humam Majd, whose latest book is The Ayatollah's Democracy, an Iranian Challenge, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ludit Lopate. Let's talk a bit about the structure of the Iranian government. Well, first of all, elections are not a new thing.
Not at all. No.
1909, the first democratic election?
1906 was the Constitutional Revolution, where it forced the Shah, the Constitutional Revolution forced the Shah at the time to have a real parliament that could actually operate independent from the king.
And then was there a democracy until the overthrow of Mossadegh?
Not really, no, because the Shah, with the help of the Western powers and Russia, was able to squash that. So not until, and then of course the Shah's father, Reza Shah, overthrew the previous monarch and became an absolute dictator. And then there was a parliament. There was still a parliament. There were still elections, but they were meaningless. And then the Shah, who was put on the throne by the Allies in World War II, and his father was deposed by the Allies because of his support for Nazi Germany, the Shah allowed a lot more democracy. And in the early, he was a very young man. He was 21. He was viewed as ineffectual and relatively weak. And Mossadegh, the elected prime minister, elected by parliament, which was elected, obviously we know the history of that. That was the first time since 1906 when there was a real sense of democracy or the possibility of democracy in Iran.
Well, how is the parliament structured? Is it more like the U.S. Congress or more like the British parliament or parliament?
It's a mixture of the British and the American system, but the people vote directly for their parliamentarians, with the exception of a handful of parliamentarians from the minorities. For example, a Jewish parliamentarian in Iran, member of parliament, is voted on only by the Jewish community in Iran. The Zoroastrian is voted on only by Zoroastrians.
With repression of various religious minorities, has that had some kind of impact on that?
In terms of what? In terms of
whether somebody appears in parliament.
Oh, no, the minority members of parliament, the religious minorities, and there's two Christians, a Zoroastrian and a Jew, they work actively in the Iranian parliament. They show up to work every day. They're active. And in fact, they've been able to get a lot of things done in favor of their constituencies.
One of my listeners, Chanel Ross from the Upper West Side, wrote into our website, "I know Iran has presidential election, but how does succession work among the clergy? Could Ayatollah Khamenei be replaced at any point?"
Yes, he can be. The Assembly of Experts, which I mentioned earlier on, is voted on by the people. They have a six-year term rather than 4 years. So the people vote for the Assembly of Experts. The Assembly of Experts, in turn, picks and supervises the Supreme Leader. Arguably, it has the power to – not arguably, it does have the power to impeach the Supreme Leader. And there were a lot of rumors early on, right after the elections of 2009, that there was perhaps a movement to do so, to actually censure or impeach the Supreme Leader. Now, obviously, the Supreme Leader won that battle. His supporters in the Assembly of Experts prevented that from happening, prevented an impeachment proceeding from happening. But the Supreme Leader is he's not very young, he's not very old, he's 70 years old. Eventually he will go. So whether he'll go retire on his own because of health, for example, or whether he'll just die, at that point the Assembly of Experts will pick the next Supreme Leader.
So it's like picking the Pope.
Yes. Yes.
Instead of the cardinals, yes. You have the Assembly of Experts. With all the stories about journalists being taken as prisoners, were you ever worried about your safety when you were in Iran?
Yes.
Because Americans have been arrested and accused of working for the CIA.
Yes. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, hardline media in Iran accused me of intimated that I might be CIA. I mean, these things happen every now and then. If I'd been in Tehran 2 weeks ago because of something I wrote, I guess it would have been dangerous for me. I was, when I went in the end of April this year, nothing happened. I wasn't arrested. I wasn't questioned. And I had my pass, my press pass and all the so on and so forth. In some ways, I was a little offended. They must not think I'm very important.
Is political discourse more or less permissible now than it was before the election? Is Ahmadinejad being more strident toward dissidents?
Well, it depends on who you describe as dissidents. The Green Movement leaders are very restricted, but there are still other reformists who are not actively in the Green Movement or who weren't, campaign aides for either Mousavi or Karoubi, who are pretty vocal. And there are plenty of websites that are operational in Iran still. Very few newspapers, only one newspaper that could be argued to be on the reform side. Now, if you're talking about dissidents on the conservative side, that there's a lot of that, and there's a lot of criticism of Ahmadinejad. So there's a lot of political discourse in that sense.
And you have some of the clerics with their own blogs.
I mean, Qom is an interesting town. It's the only town in Iran that has fiber optics.
Is there a certain measure of national pride when Ahmadinejad is cheered by Hezbollah supporters in Lebanon?
It's hard to say. I think for his supporters, absolutely. I think there's probably a certain amount of national pride among many Iranians, whether they like Ahmadinejad or not, that it's really Iran that's being cheered in Lebanon. It's not the person of Ahmadinejad. I would argue that if Mousavi had become president and went to Lebanon this week, he would receive the same kind of reception that Ahmadinejad has. I think, you know, the idea that a lot of Iranians don't like the idea when the economy is bad that Iran spends so much money on Hezbollah and Hamas, for example. But moral support for Hezbollah and Hamas is very strong across, you know, the political spectrum, even the left wing in Iran. So I think there's some pride that the influence of Iran is growing, for example, and is Iran is able to project its power beyond its own borders. I think there's some pride. Yeah.
Well, it described itself as an Islamic state. Would it be possible for democracy in Iran, let's say true democracy somewhere down the line, to ever be separated from religion?
Well, that's down the line, I think probably yes. In the immediate future or in the near future, I would say it's going to be very difficult. I mean, Khatami gave a speech a few years ago when he was president saying that the only way democracy is going to come to Iran is through Islam. And what he meant, and he said that otherwise we will have a dictatorship in Iran.
But he's a cleric.
He's a cleric, absolutely. And he believes that very strongly because he also said in many other speeches and talks that the people, he recognizes the people of Iran still are very, very religious and as a majority are very religious.
No matter who's responsible for the state of the U.S. economy, the party in power is being blamed.
Yes.
The economy in Iran keeps on getting worse day by day. Cost of living is rising. Are people blaming the government?
Yes. Even Ahmadinejad's former allies are blaming him for mismanagement of the economy. Now, there's another factor in play here, and that's Western and U.S. sanctions and U.N. sanctions that affect the economy.
So you can always blame that the same way Castro blamed U.S. embargo.
It does give them a convenience. It has two advantages for a government like Ahmadinejad's. One, they can blame foreigners for trying to, you know, force Iran to change its behavior and punish it with these economic sanctions. The other thing it can do for a government like Ahmadinejad is to say, we have to be unified now in the face of these threats that we're facing right now, with even of military action against us.
Humam Maj's latest book is The Ayatollah's Democracy, an Iranian Challenge, published by Norton. His name is spelled Houmanmajd. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.